I'm very glad you're here, Tony, because I forgot to answer part of your question. And at the end of class, after everybody left, or after most everybody left, I remembered, because you had used a phrase that I really wanted to respond to. You had said, you had used the words, I wrote it down as agonizing, but I think what you meant is agonizing. You mentioned about agonizing sometimes to really know what God's will is. And when you said that phrase, it stayed with me. And I sort of wanted to just speak to that a little bit, because it seems like a really important point to discuss. My recollection is that I didn't say what I'm about to say. If I did, we'll all get to hear it a second time. I know people give a lot of energy to trying to make every decision as God wants you to make it. And I know that that's the right thing to do. At the same time, a great many decisions either don't matter at all, or they're really obvious common sense, and we cause ourselves, the Catholics have a word for it, it's called over-scrupulosity, where you just become so kind of intently concerned that everything you do is right, that pretty soon your entire concern is for yourself and the fear that you're going to do something wrong. I fell into it, have fallen into it a number of times in my life, but very dramatically a few times. And the way it actually felt to me is that what happens is you narrow the spiritual path. In fact, this is what Swami said. You make the spiritual path narrow and narrow until you fall off of it, because there's just no place left to stand, because everything is an agony about whether God really wants me to do it or not. I recall when we were contemplating establishing the community that we now have, and that was now 18 years ago, which is quite a long time. You know, small children have become big in that course of period of time. And you know, it seemed like such a big thing. We were all anxious as to whether this was God's will or not. And at a certain point, I asked Swamiji, essentially, how can we know if this is God's will? And his answer was very helpful. He said, Asha, self-evidently, it's a good thing. You know, you don't have to agonize over it. Of course God would like us to have a community here. Essentially, why not? And I know a lot of times people will bring me a question. For example, all these India pilgrimages that we've led, people will come and they'll come with this big question, does God really want me to go on the pilgrimage? Should I go on the pilgrimage? And I always say, you should reverse that. You should say, why not go? It's like, it's going to be a great spiritual experience. Instead of always thinking that God's answer is going to be no, you should really just assume it's going to be yes. And you see, it orients everything very differently. If you just ask yourself, is there any reason not to do this? Now, of course, I'm not talking about bad things. I'm talking about things that are self-evidently good. You know, to go on spiritual retreat, to go on pilgrimages, to follow Swami around the world, whatever it is that you're feeling to do, to start a community, to serve. When it's self-evidently an uplifting thing, don't agonize over it, just do it. Because it'll create good energy. And the other fact is, about that, is God is far more interested in your sincere desire to live in harmony with higher reality than he is concerned about the details. The human rational mind thinks that all these little permutations on the wave matter, but they don't really. It's really just a generous flow of energy in an outwardly giving manner. And even more than that, there's a story in the book about Swami where this woman wrote to Swami and she faced what looked to anybody from the outside like really big decisions. I can't remember whether it was about getting married or something, but it was something big, something that you would think of as big. And the woman said, I've prayed and prayed to Master, you know, should I take this course or that course? And whether it was getting married or not, it was something that was going to have a big effect on her life. And I just don't get an answer. Swami said, do either one, it doesn't make any difference. He said, God is pleased that you sincerely wish to live in harmony with the divine. That sincere desire is really all that matters. The details make very little difference. Because part of it, and this is a little bit crushing to the ego, and Swami put it this way, this one woman came to him once, and she was involved in this really horrible relationship with this man, but she had this, what I can only call a superstitious fear, that somehow he was her ordained mate for life, even though they didn't get along and didn't like each other, you know. And so she sort of was asking Swamiji, you know, all common sense said that she should get away from this fellow, they should get away from each other, but she was afraid he was the one, and Swami, in a common sense sort of way, helped her through it. I'm just going to keep, don't let me lose this spot. Let me see if I have to say it. No, I think I've already lost, so I'll go forward. But he said afterwards, he said, when she left, he said, she has so many lessons to learn, she could learn them with any number of people. He said, you have to be very advanced before your choices are so narrow. And it's a very interesting point. We have so many lessons, we can just be learning this one or learning this one or learning this one. You have to be down to the very last ones, and then you're not asking these questions. You know, then you just have so little karma left, you're just flowing. It's so much more. In fact, it's entirely the attitude and the consciousness with which we do things, rather than the specific things that we do. We can make of a good thing a bad thing, and of a bad thing a good thing. It's another story in there when a person was really going to make a huge change in their life and became very insecure and said, Swami, is this a good or a bad thing? He said, it's just a thing. He said, whether it becomes good or bad entirely depends on whether it feeds your ego or helps you to overcome it. And whether it does that is how you relate to it. The thing in itself is neutral. I mean, really, think about how many incarnations we've had and how many we may have and how many billions of different things that we've done. Really, it just doesn't make any difference. And now we can get ourselves so hung up that we think, I can only learn here, I can only learn there, I'm going to get bad here, I'm going to get... No, 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 no. Just be cheerful and happy and don't agonize. Make almost any decision. And if you have that joyful, surrendered attitude, things work out. And if you're all tense about it, they never work out anyway, because you can't do anything. Do you see the difference? So most of the time, many times people come to me, this is my favorite. I don't mean to make fun of you, because you'll be afraid to come and talk to me. Everything I'm saying to you, I've learned from doing. You know, when people come and say something to me, I can just visualize myself having said it to Swami more times than anybody's ever said it to me. But let's see, I lost the thought. Try to find it. Oh, yes. People will often come to me with this intense need to make it, you know, to choose among options. But when we actually analyze it, they don't have any choices. They just, the whole idea of choice is just a myth. I mean, there's really only one that's practical a great deal of the time. I know sometimes we have tiny choices, but a great deal of the time, either you really have no other options or your desires are so committed. You don't really have a choice. You're pretending you have a choice. But you don't. It's like when couples come arm in arm, you know, linked at the hip and say, what do you think, Swami? Should we be together? Well, gee, I don't know. I can't really get even a thin knife between you, so maybe you should be together. There's not a choice at that point. The desire has already been acted upon. And oftentimes people will try, including me, to act as if this is still up for grabs, but it isn't. It's over. And we just have to have the humility to just admit that and not like play games with God and ourselves and just say, okay, you know, my energy is going this way, even if, and no sensitive counselor would ever tell you no at that point. That's what I mean. You know, by the time you come to Swami arm in arm and ask if he approves of your relationship, it's like he wouldn't say, well, so what's he going to do? Say no? It's a story in the book. It wasn't the specific incident, but, you know, someone came asking Swami, as Swami put it, for advice, but what they really wanted was his approval. And Swami looked at him and said, you know, this man does not have the capacity to renounce this desire, and if I ask him to renounce it, it will just create within him a horrible complex. It's not worth it. So I said, you know, he was very, Swami in that particular instance was very, because he said he had to be sincere. So the man said, do I have your blessings? And Swami said, you always have my blessings. I bless you. He didn't say, I bless what you're doing. The man, of course, heard it. Swami said, I couldn't be more explicit than that, is how he put it. I had to leave it to his intuition, and the intuition was blinded by desire. So the man walked away thinking that Swami had blessed his decision, which eventually proved a disaster for him, you know. But Swami had simply blessed him. As much as possible, Swami writes in the Path, it's one of the more chilling phrases in the Path, as much as possible, Master allowed us to live out our fantasies. That's how he said it. Because we would learn, that's the way we'd learn. You don't learn by somebody thwarting your desires. That's the old Kali Yuga form of monasticism, where the idea is that you crush the spirit of the poor little postulant and somehow that makes them into a good monk or a nun. It doesn't. It just makes them into a poor, crushed postulant. I know a lot of us, including me, if I feel, all of us feel certain threads of reincarnation in us. You know, I can feel having been crushed as a postulant in some of those horrific medieval convents. And just the all-pervasive insecurity it creates in a person. It doesn't create humility, it just creates an obsessive anxiety about whether you're ever going to do anything right or not. Because that kind of crushing of the spirit is not a harmonious flowing with the person's energy. It's just, whatever you are, I'm going to smash it. And a few people are capable of rising, but many more people are just have their spirits crushed, and then you spend incarnations recovering from it. So you don't want to perpetuate it on yourself now that you don't have some fierce novice mistress, you know, beating the tar out of you. Don't take on her role or his role, which leads us into part of what we're talking about today, but I'll wait till we get there. It's the part about being a friend, God's friend. But I'll read the Gita, because last time I didn't read the Gita till 8:45, which was a little odd, so maybe I won't do that. Is there any questions about that at all? Is that okay, Tony? Did I finish your answering you? I thought it was important to answer you. You especially, you've had your Dharma laid out for you for so much of your life. Oh, I know what I was going to say. And you've done an admirable job of rising to it, I would say. Someone asked Swamiji once, how can you know what your Dharma is? The question was asked with a great deal of angst. How do I know what, you know, what is the right duty for me and that God will bring me to God consciousness? Sometimes when you ask a question with so much like that, Swami answers you, the way he answers you is as much as the answer. And he answered, Swami, yeah, if a job needs to be done and you're next in line. That's how he put it. You know, just essentially, again, just taking all the self-concern out of it and just putting it right on, use your common sense. It's very helpful. I think it's also helpful, and I did say it, but I just wanted to say it one more time. If your desires, don't pretend you can renounce a desire if you can't. What avail suppression? Remember it was in there? You can admit, and it's very helpful to keep the teaching straight. It's very important to say, this is just my desire. I really don't know if this is God's will. But it's just my desire, but it is my desire. I can't go beyond it. So Lord, you're going to have to come with me on this ride. We're going to have to work it out together. But then everything is straight. All you've done is follow a desire. You haven't laid this entire complex on top of it, which is an entirely separate problem. And that's the statement that is in so many of the scriptures, and especially the teachers in person, including Swami on Sunday night, said this to us. God is pleased when you give him your successes, but he's more pleased when you give him your failures. Because it's harder. To give God your failures is to have, really, to have the personal strength of character to be able to just admit your limitations. And it takes really much more strength of character to see your imperfections and not shrink and hide, try to hide them. I mean, when you're doing well, who cares? Of course, everybody can know. But when you're doing badly, I mean, the tendency to try to cover that up is so intense. But to just say, well, Lord, we went out and we didn't succeed today. I remember once I was facing this test that was so big, so much bigger than I felt at that time, that I knew that, and this was my prayer and meditation in the morning, Lord, you give me an opportunity, I fall. There's no question about it. There is zero capacity for me to do the right thing in this situation. Just zero. Said, the only hope we have is that you keep me from having a chance. And I said, and I'm going to fight you all day long once I leave this meditation room. I said, but at least right now I'm clear enough to know, and I'd be darned if he just didn't make my desire impossible day after day. But, you know, I had to start by saying, let's not kid around, Lord. We're so far off from being centered here. And that's where Swami says, take God with you. That's what he's trying to say, take God with you. That's where the power comes from, is fearlessness. I used to be very, very bad at this. This is something I learned very slowly. I used to always pretend in front of Swami think I talked about that last week. You know, he said, you always want to, you know, he wasn't sarcastic, but you always want to appear to be a good disciple. I know, sir, you're not fooling me. In other words, you know, pretense is not being a good disciple, because what does that say? That's saying, I'm afraid to show you who I really am because I don't believe you'll love me. It says, I have to earn God's love. I mean, all those are real falsehoods, but that's really what you're doing. If you knew, really saw who I was, you wouldn't love me anymore, so I have to pretend. I'm always earning this. And that was Swami, again, I put this in the book, Swami reprimanded me for that one once really strongly when I got myself in a ton of trouble. I'm not sure I wrote this as a first-person story. I think I did. I got myself in a lot of trouble, and he was in seclusion. And I really needed his help, but I didn't want to ask him because he was in seclusion. It seems nice, but somebody else intervened for me, so Swami sent for me. And he wasn't speaking, so he sat at the typewriter and wrote answers, and I would speak, and then he would write answers, and he sort of, we conversed, you know, a lot by intuition, and also just by him writing out. He's a fast typist, so we managed. And I got clarity about what I was doing, what I should do. Then we were walk all the way back to the front door. He was escorting me out, and I said, I'm really sorry, though, that I had to interrupt your seclusion. I wish so-and-so had not spoken to you. I feel so badly about this. He got like this. And he took me back to the office and typed out, and he wrote, you insult my friendship. You know, wow, that's not at all what I thought. I thought I was being so considerate. He said that you would think that my convenience was more important than your welfare. It was a very important lesson for me, because sometimes we think we're being so considerate, and really what we're saying is that that person doesn't have the generosity of heart to respond to me, or he's not really my own. You know? My rule of thumb has been for my life, for most of my life, if I would be willing to do it, I think they'd be willing to do it. And so I just figure, why would I think that other people will be less generous than I would be? How would I feel? I mean, I learned a lot from that with Swami, and it took a long time to just really trust that. Of course, consideration is fundamental, but nonetheless, if someone really loves you, it hurts their feelings when you don't trust that love, doesn't it? Isn't it more hurtful to have them not trust that you would love them than it is to interrupt their privacy? You see the difference? And in a spiritual relationship, I mean, this doesn't always act out in an interpersonal way. This, you know, many of those external experiences that God gave me over those years were so that I could write them down and so we'd have them. Because all of us are going to live, and Swami's going to live long after he lives, just like Master has. So we have to understand what right attitude is, because a great deal of this is within ourselves. Because it's when we close off inwardly, God can't help us. And, you know, we do a great deal of just self-protective all by ourselves. Who are we fooling? We're just fooling ourselves. It doesn't take you anywhere. Right? That all seemed to be implied by your question, and I wanted to finish. Any other questions or thoughts? All right, then. I pick up the Gita. This is chapter 16. Last time we did Freedom Through Action, which is the Gita talking about Karma Yoga. Now, this is chapter 16 of the book, and it's called The Supreme Science of Knowing God. And we are now up to chapter 4 of the 18 chapters of the Gita. Chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. The exalted Lord said to Arjuna, I gave this imperishable yoga to Vivaswat, the sun god. Vivaswat passed on the knowledge to Manu, the Hindu lawgiver. Manu taught it to Ishvaku, founder of the solar dynasty of the Kshatriyas. Thus handed down in orderly succession, the Raja Rishis, royal rishis or sages, knew it. With the long passage of time, however, O scorcher of foes, Arjuna, this knowledge of yoga has become greatly diminished on earth. For 3, today I have taught you, Krishna says, my devotee and friend, that ancient science of yoga, the secret to the highest blessings for mankind. The operative word in there is friend. 4:4. Arjuna said, Vivasvat lived in far-off antiquity. You, however, were born recently. How am I to take this statement that it was you who first taught this sacred yoga to mankind? 4:5. The Blessed Lord said, many have been my births, and many also yours. I remember all of mine, though you remember yours not. 4:6. Though I, a fully liberated soul, am the Lord of all creation, and am in my true self, and abiding ever in my cosmic nature, forever unborn, yet I, by my yoga maya, assume from time to time an outward form. 4:7 and 8. O Bharata, Arjuna, whenever virtue, dharma, declines, and vice, adharma, is in the ascendant, I incarnate myself on earth as an avatar. Appearing from age to age in visible form, I come to destroy evil and to reestablish virtue. That's it. Those are the end. All right. I remember when Swamiji, I think I remember this accurately, I think it was this particular verse. There's a number of verses where they're just lists of things. We start with Vivasvat, then we go to Manu, then we go to Ishvaku, and then we go down like this, and they just look like lists. Swami just sort of was pondering when he was writing the Gita commentary. He was pondering, you know, like, what do I do with this list? What does this really mean? And then Swami remembered, and Master inspired him with the thought that this is about the cycles of the yugas. This is about how there's a high age in which these ideas come forth, and then gradually they get passed down until gradually they're lost. Now, part of this is all talking about the yuga cycles, which most of you know about, but not all of you completely. It's a whole amazing class in itself, which I won't go into in depth here. But the basic concept, and it's an extremely important one for understanding our teachings, is it's an ancient understood truth in India, which is gradually becoming more and more appreciated in the West because scientific evidence is beginning to verify it. We have tended to think that humanity on Earth has developed from nothing in a sort of a straight line that's slanted upward to the present moment, that everything behind us was less evolved and now we've reached the apex of civilization. It's a really grim and gruesome thought in itself. And it also is not borne out by anything else that you see. And what the tradition of India is quite different, is that it's been, and in many other traditions too, that on planet Earth, and we're talking planetary cycle, it's been a circular cycle of increasing awareness that reaches an apex, that gradually fades again, and then on planet Earth it enters a dark age, then it reaches a nadir, and then gradually consciousness goes up again. And without going into all the essences of it, yes? Yeah, that's what I was going to... the whole solar system, not planet Earth. Thank you. I always use the wrong words. Universe, galaxy, solar system. The only word I really know is Earth, so I use it. But the concept is that our sun... This whole phenomenon is based on astronomy. Not astrology, but astronomy. It's based on physical relationships between the placement of our solar system in relation to what they call the grand central source of energy, and that we go in an elliptical orbit in relation, these are all Sri Yukteswar's explanations, in an elliptical orbit held in place by a dual sun, which also is another solar system with its planets, and this elliptical orbit moves us closer and farther away from this grand central source of energy. So that this solar system at various times, and this whole cycle, according to the Indian tradition, is 24,000 years. And so it moves, this planet Earth moves gradually closer and then farther away, and whatever our dual is going to be at the opposite point. Now bear in mind, when we give this class as a whole class, we talk about it as personal and planetary evolution. We're talking about a physical phenomenon on this physical planet. Now, Master speaks of, I think in this section or maybe another, yes, it's in this section, that life exists on many planets, that, you know, there's so many ways in which life can be. The idea that we're the only intelligent life in the universe is just completely absurd. And Master just, you know, says very simply, UFOs, of course, are, you know, a perfectly natural thing. That Swamiji once had a dream, a very strange dream, in which a group of emissaries from another solar system, from a completely other planet, came to him when he was in his sleep. He presented this dream as if it was a real dream, and they asked him, they said they really needed a spiritual inspiration on their planet, and they wanted him to come back with them to their planet to help them. Because they'd just come, you know, to find him because they needed someone inspiring to help them. And Swamiji, his heart was, you know, went out to these people who'd come all this distance, and he was inclined to go with them. But then he said he remembered, oh, new culture, new language, new everything. He said, I just don't think I want to start over at this point. So he declined. And, you know, the question lingers, would he have died if he had gone with them? Would he have been in two places at the same time? Was it fantasy? Was it real? I tried to write it in the book, but Swami said, oh, Asha, you can't write that one. But it was so fascinating to me, and it still is. So, but that would be, it's apocryphal, if not actual, because it's the same reality everywhere. But the soul, and Swami asked this question of Master, does the soul always incarnate on the same planet? And Master said, of course not. He said, if you just came back to the same planet, this was Master's, you know, discouraging words, you would figure it out too fast. He said, there's many, many planets that you can go to, and they're all, in one way or another, running the same cycle, so that they're at different stages of awareness. Now, all you have to do, what we are, the nadir, as the book said today, the nadir of materialistic, limited thinking was 500 A.D., and the real shift out of the materialistic age into the age of energy came at 1700, it began, and then the real transition point was it was 1900. And just think what's happened in the last century in terms of people seeing the world in terms of energy. I mean, everything that we see around us, somebody told me, what did someone say? They said that I think Karen and David were saying this from having been at the Houston Space Center. I may have this a little bit wrong, but I think this is what they said. They said the entire computer, which was, you know, filled a huge room that powered some of the first space flights, has less computing power than your wristwatch has now. Is that anywhere near accurate? It was something like that. But it's just a phenomenal shift in understanding energy. Before, even we use the word, how many horsepower does it have? You know, where did that come from? Because people could only conceive of power in terms of something they could see. Now we'll talk about horsepower, but we're never thinking. Nobody could measure how much power a horse would have. But when it first began, when people first began to convert into more subtle forms of energy, that's what they had to do. It was from the materialistic age to the energy age. That's where we are now. This age is 3,600 years, I think, including the transitions. Have I said that right? No, it's 2,400. But it doesn't really make any difference, because your soul, once it exits your physical body and goes into the astral world, you're not necessarily an earthling. You're only an earthling because you're on Earth right now. You might come back to Earth. Swamiji writes about how our masters have a very strong relationship, seemingly, to this planet. Is it the only planet they help? Is it the only one they incarnate? In all those years when they're not here, are they somewhere else? Are they just passing time in the causal world? You know, where are they during that period of time? How many realms simultaneously are they running? You know, these are questions the mind can just trip out forever and have really tons of fun and know nothing at the end anyway. But it just does take the walls of your mind down and makes you a little less smug, which is very helpful. But the soul, your soul, my soul, will reincarnate on the planet that is in the appropriate state of evolution for you. It's not like you can just sort of like hold on to this planet until it evolves and that you'll evolve with it. Of course you can't, you'll just die. And once you're out of your material body, you're not on this planet anymore. And if this planet becomes too refined for you, you'll just find a grosser one to go to. Or if this one becomes too gross for you, you'll find a more refined one to go. However, self-realized masters come to planets with their army of devotees, which is what I consider us to be, at all different stages. Because sometimes what you need to be is you need to be on a planet that's very gross to provide an intense contrast for what you're trying to learn. Or you come to serve that planet, or like Jesus did. Jesus came, you know, it was descending, Kali Yuga going down, and it went down for 500 more years after he was there. But he and those he touched were completely untouched by the grossness of the planet, but it required a certain kind of response. And that's why the immediate response after Jesus died was the desert fathers were the really powerful big movement, the isolated monasteries, the complete withdrawal from the physical world, the material life, because it was just too gross to deal with. It was just too barbaric. It was too limited in its thinking. There was no way you could have a very expanded spiritual consciousness and live in that unimaginative world in which they built cathedrals bigger and bigger because that was the only way they could think of to show how big God was. You know, God was so big that the cathedrals had to be really big and the ceilings had to be way above you so that you would necessarily feel really small in relationship to him. It was just an extremely densely materialistic understanding trying to cope with the concept of infinity. But now, of course, we've moved into an age when all of these things are so much more subtle that we can think about it on a completely different level. And this is why the concept of withdrawing from society, that's why the monasteries are not really popular right now. The monasteries are emptying out. Not because renunciation is not a fundamental fact of the spiritual path. Don't misunderstand. But that style of renunciation, which just hates the world and pushes the world away and everything about the flesh is evil, that style of renunciation is past. Because now we're in a subtle age of energy. And people can live more in this world and be spiritual at the same time. It's not necessary to separate yourself so extremely. Yes?
So, once I'm a disciple of Master, I'm going to remain a disciple of Master. Master's not going to forget me. And I'm going to reincarnate wherever is my next step, which might not be here on earth, and Master must be available, I hope, wherever else I'm going.
That's actually a very, very interesting point, Sharmila. I never actually thought of it exactly like that.
Otherwise, it's really scary.
Oh, no, don't be scared.
I mean,
No, the teaching, the fundamental teaching is that Master has promised to take care of you. Once that bond is truly formed, and the forming of that bond is our responsibility. But once we have really wholeheartedly given ourselves to him, he's stuck with us. So either we spend a long time coming back to earth because we're doing his job with him.
Well, that's what I was thinking too, because it seems like
we might just be needed here.
We have a work to do that's ongoing.
Right. Or he's happening on other planets at the same time, and we go help him in lots of places. It's a very interesting question. Swami was asked once whether you reincarnate backwards in time. Actually, one of our attorneys, I had to ride up to Ananda Village once with one of our attorneys, not John Parsons, but Rob Christopher, who was much less versed in these teachings, so he took the opportunity to ask me lots of questions, and one of his lawyerly questions was, do you only reincarnate forward, or do you reincarnate backwards? I'd never thought of it before. Swami, what's the answer to that? He said, time doesn't exist outside of the relative universe, but within the relative universe, it does exist. And so he said, you do keep going forward. You can't go backwards because, by definition, if you're reincarnating, you're bound by the time cycle. That's how he put it. So when you come back into this world, you come back in relationship to this world as you have lived in it, and therefore time is real. If you had transcended time, you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't have had to reincarnate. You may stand outside of it a little bit in the astral, but even in the astral world, they talk about time. Because you're still living in a, you still have an ego and you're still in a relative, in a dual state. It's just more subtle. It's not as gross as it is here. These are actually quite fun questions. Yeah. But that's a really good one. And I'm going to ask Swami that one sometime because that's a fabulous sort of thought about where he is. Reassured? Yeah. Time and space is no problem to him.
You don't necessarily. It would seem it might be convenient if Master were incarnate on the planet you are at, but it isn't a necessary condition to be in connection with him.
Well, this is something I often say to people when they say, oh, I don't want to be Master's disciple, I want a living guru. I thought that through. I mean, you know, you hear that and you don't quite know what to answer for years, and then finally thoughts come to you. I said, you know, Master is an avatar. He's a fully self-realized being. And by definition, he's just not going to be just coming here every single time. Chances are we're going to have a lot of incarnations when he's not going to be here. We're just going to be working on what we've gained from him or from his disciples, because he works through his those who are in tune with him also. So it's not just Master, but it's those who are in tune with him. But still, you know, the great souls are not going to incarnate as often as we do. So we've got to have a lot of lifetimes in which we don't have the Master himself. We'll probably always, though, be in company of those who can help us, because we just would be. Because it's unless you're in a very unusual incarnation in which you have this some karma to just be completely isolated, satsang is just fundamental to the spiritual path. And why would God torture us? He might, you know, he might challenge us sometimes, but if we're receptive, we're always going to be with people who will help us, our friends or people that we're helping or something, some way. So if you want a living master, one thing you're going to have to change really often, which is not the same as having a sadguru, and two, you're going to have to settle for somebody who's more on your level, who's always coming back with you, which doesn't seem like a smart idea to me. So yes, good point. Yes. This is because we make a recording, and if we don't use the mic, people can't hear it when they listen.
Thank you. In India, it's believed that human beings evolve as in reincarnation after doing a great deal of good deeds, and it takes a lot to be born as a human being.
Right.
And my question is that if it seems like then, you know, we are the creations, you know, the utmost creation of the highest power that is God. My question is that, but we also have a lot of destructive nature, if you will, right, in ourselves. So are we, in that sense, the lowest creation of the highest power, or are we the, I mean, I don't know where we stand.
That's a very good question. I love questions like that. You know why I love questions like that? It's because Swami and Master actually have answers to questions like that. I've been on this path for almost 40 years. I've never heard a question that Swami hasn't answered with Master's teachings, including that one. And here's the answer to it. You have to think about it from a different angle. What makes the human being the highest form is not because we're good, because look around, you know, we are not good. What makes us the highest form is because the nervous system contained within the human body has the capacity to expand its awareness to infinity. A dog's nervous system is simply not refined enough for it to be able to become that self-aware. But the human body nervous system is refined enough. That's why the great good karma is to have a human body. That's how it's spoken. Because you've had a dog's body, you've had an elephant body, you've had a dolphin's body, you've had a whale's body, all of which have certain benefits, but none of them have the innate, inherent capacity to expand the awareness within it to infinity. That's why scientists talk about how we only use a very small percentage of our brain power, and they can't quite figure out why we've got 90% unused. Because that's the 90% that when we gradually expand into it by the systematic practice of yoga, we do utilize it. And they, you know, now they hook up the brains of yogis. They're beginning to apply Dwapara understanding to these things, and they're beginning to test and read the brains of meditating peoples and realizing that meditation changes your brain. You know, things begin to happen. Master himself speaks of when one of his disciples really wanted cosmic consciousness and kept sort of badgering Yogananda to give him a samadhi experience. Master said essentially it would just burn up your nervous system. You wouldn't be able to, you aren't refined enough to have that much energy running through you. So what the height is the potential for self-awareness. And also what makes the human being advance is because it does have the self-awareness to have free will, and therefore to influence or deter its own evolution. Because the eventual expansion of self-awareness is not a passive thing. It's a deliberate act of determination and effort on the part of the individual soul, motivated by the wealth of things that happen to us. So human beings also have the free will to use their expanded awareness, which is greater than the animals, to for self-aggrandizement in the most horrible possible way, until by our own experience we learn, integrate those lessons, and then by an act of will begin to live at a higher and higher level. So it's how gross the human beings are on a planet is dependent on what stage of evolution that planet is in. Now this planet is in a transition from materialism, from the materialistic age to the age of energy. And what you see is this huge conflict between the fixed dogmatism, I mean, in religion that's what you see, this fixed dogmatic attitude versus this much freer, more spiritual attitude, and the two fighting it out. And so individuals have come who have the karma to do those battles. Also, because it's a transition age and a great deal of what has been has to be destroyed to make way for what's coming, there's also a lot of demons on this planet with us, because it's like, hey, Earth is transitioning. This is a time when we can destroy. And so a lot of folks come to destroy. And they're just, you know, they're ripping the place to pieces. They're ripping each other to pieces. A great deal of the violence that's happening is essentially civil war. You know, Rwanda and even India with the Pakistanis and the Muslims, and people, and Muslim against Muslim, and people just tearing each other to bits. Extremely barbaric. But that's because everything is cracking apart right now. And then simultaneously, you have these very refined souls who are here to help Master and other gurus to establish this new consciousness that will gradually find its way. And it's all happening simultaneously. These are considered to be very auspicious incarnations for devotees, because there's a lot of incentive here. When everything is just lovely, there's less incentive. The first 10 years that I lived at Ananda Village, it was like being in the astral world. It was just so fun. We were so isolated. We lived a completely alternate life. We were so little involved with the world. We had no television. We had no radios. We just lived this complete, fabulous life. I don't know whether I made less or more spiritual progress, but I certainly didn't think as much about getting free, because there was nothing to get free from. And then, you know, reality set in with a vengeance. And I had to look at life much more seriously. I had to grow up. And maybe it made me, I don't know, bliss is also a great incentive for more bliss. So you don't just learn from suffering. You learn from being happy and realizing you can be endlessly happy. So it's not necessary to suffer. But it's certainly, I'm far stronger from having to deal with contrast than I was when I didn't. Does that answer your question? Okay, very good. Any other questions? All of this, as I was starting to say, is really very, very important, because the more clearly we can understand God's plan to a certain point, the more relaxed and accepting it is to be. I mean, this is not a path that just tells you to believe. You know, God's got it all figured out. I've been reading just so that you know, not this book is huge, but Swami has gotten ahead of us, because he's now published this book about the Christian teaching too, Revelations of Christ, which I've been reading. I have to do a program on it Thursday night at the bookstore in Santa Cruz, so I've been studiously reading that. What was I going to say about it? Darn it, I lost the thought. Oh, I know what it is. But it's like, he was talking about how the traditional fundamentalist Christians don't have any real answers for anything. Jesus was just the only Son of God, and he just sort of happened, and nobody really knows why, and just believe it, you know, have faith like this. But that's not really an answer. We want to understand, not just in this like super rational way, but also from the heart. But it doesn't have to be unreasonable for it to be true. It can all come together in a really beautiful way. And this theory of the yugas just takes a whole lot of factors about life and puts them into a sort of a comfortable way that you can live with it. Of course, this is a very disrupted age. It so happens now that things are expanding in a positive direction, which gives purpose and meaning to the work that we're doing. If the teaching in India, which Sri Yukteswar corrected, is that it's Kali Yuga descending and is going to be for some hundreds of thousands of years more. We're not at all schooled in that, because the only thing we know about it we got from Sri Yukteswar, from Yogananda's guru, and he corrected a misunderstanding that set in during Kali Yuga. When these are how the stories are. When Krishna was alive and Arjuna, and the point came when Arjuna and Yudhishthira and all his brothers just left the kingdom in the hands of Arjuna's grandson, and everybody who knew anything left and went to the forest. And all the people that were left were too ignorant to get anything straight, and this great misunderstanding set in. That's how the story is told. And I think it's true. So they don't understand that Dwapara Yuga has started. And friends of ours who are in another ashram, they hold to the thought that it's Kali Yuga descending. Their whole attitude towards serving the world is completely different. It's essentially, what's the point? You see, when they were in those Christian monasteries, when the desert fathers just went off and lived in those caves and had nothing to do with society, what was the point? It was a hopeless task to even consider building any kind of work or laying any groundwork, because it was Kali Yuga descending. And when Vyasa comes and teaches this, he puts up this historical thing and just shows you how this horde of barbarians swept through, and then this horde of barbarians swept through, and then this was destroyed, and this was destroyed, and this was destroyed. Everything was destroyed because it was Kali Yuga descending. And the little tiny bit of knowledge was kept alive in the isolated monasteries. They kept, you know, a little bit of scholarliness and understanding in the teachings of Christ, but there was no point in coming out of those caves into society. But so we also have this mindset, this Kali Yuga mindset, that everything just goes to pieces, and what's the point? But you see, now we're in Kali Yuga ascending, where people's understanding is going to get more and more subtle, and where Master has said, after this period of transition, which Master said will get much worse, and there'll be much more chaos, as, you know, a lot of things just have to go away before the planet. And Dwapara Yuga is not all that good. You still have war. And if you still have war, it's telling you that people are not all that smart. In fact, Dwapara Yuga is quite insecure because people have more subtle means of destruction that they can use. But at the same time, there's a more widespread understanding, as Swami writes it here, of subtle energy, and therefore you can practice yoga a lot more because you understand subtle energy. You're not just propitiating a foreign god. You're actually working with it within yourself. But you see, that completely defines our work, is that we are sowing seeds for a mission that will gradually become into greater and greater stages of acceptance. And Swamiji has written all these books which almost no one reads. And of the people who read them, only a few even understand them, and almost no one acts on them. Has he wasted his incarnation? Of course not. What he's done, the way I think about it, is Swamiji has completely described self-realization culture. He's created a whole alternate culture of self-realization and described how to do it. How to raise children, how to do business, how to have families, how to create art, and he has all this music that goes with it, and then he talks about the scriptures, he talks about it's 90 books. And they're all just piled up there, and gradually people are going to care. And when they begin to care, all of that's going to come out much more importantly. And even the work that we do here, and I mean, many of you are very deeply involved here, it's nice if we're popular. because we're helping people. It's nice to help people, but it's far more important that we remain in tune with the fundamental vision that Master and Swamiji are trying to plant. Because if we can maintain that vibration and pass that vibration on, that in time will have power. If in the name of trying to conform to a society that we're not in tune with anyway, we dilute that vibration, then, you know, as generations pass, it'll just dissipate into nothing. And that's why we have to be very careful. I mean, we don't have to be afraid and we don't have to be a fundamentalist because that's antithetical to it. We just have to be very conscious. And that's why we use the phrase, we have to do what's in tune. It can be very creative. It can depart completely from anything that's ever been done before, as long as it has the right vibration. You see what I mean? And all that's because of the yugas. In other words, we'd just be off in the monastery somewhere just working on our own salvation. It would be pointless to serve the world. You see? Okay, why don't we take a little break? All right, I think we can go again. All right. So, or do we have questions or shall I go on? Well, the next, you know, there's sort of a whole series of points in here, and the point that I really wanted to talk about now for a few minutes is this lovely point where Krishna calls Arjuna friend. Swami makes a big point of that. It's really an extremely, again, it's another, I was touching on it earlier and then I held back because I wanted to do it in context. Everything about the spiritual path is really your inward relationship with God. That's what I was speaking about at the beginning. It's really so little about what we do and so much about our consciousness. In fact, entirely about our consciousness. That's where this particular section of readings has all of that about how avatars are all exactly the same in their consciousness. The only way you can measure them at all is by the, quote, greatness of their mission, which is what they've been sent by God to do. But it's all about inward consciousness. And it's all about overcoming this misunderstanding about who we are and who God is in relationship to us, who the Guru is. One of the reasons that God incarnates in these human forms is that we have living examples that we can meditate on their consciousness and draw their consciousness into ourselves, that we can meditate on the stories of their lives, that from time to time in our incarnations we have the opportunity to be close to them or be close to those who were close to them. Now, it's very interesting in the story of the founding of Christianity that when Jesus died, it was a very small group of people. Only a few people did he actually touch. The real force that turned Christianity into what it was Paul. And what's so also interesting about Paul is that Paul never actually knew Jesus when Jesus was alive. That Paul was a Jew and he was a Roman and he was persecuting the Christian sect. Without ever having met Jesus, that was his job. His name was Saul at the time, and he was a fierce persecutor of this new sect of, at that point it was just a sect of Judaism, but they were trying to stamp it out. And Saul was going on the road to Damascus in order to, you know, clean out some nest of these vipers, and he was struck blind by a vision on the road to Damascus, and he was blind for a number of days, and in his blindness, he saw Christ. And Christ said, "Why do you persecute my people?" And when Paul, Saul, recovered from his blindness, he became Paul, and from that point on, he went out and preached this reality of Jesus the Christ from his own experience without ever having known him when he was living. It's an amazing story. Now, of course, he did have that all-transforming vision, but he didn't even have that vision. You know, karma is karma. Obviously, he was ready for it and by the life that he lived afterwards. And then from that point on, he devoted himself. But here's the part that's so amazing when you think about it. His conviction was so powerful that he was able to convert other people who'd never met Jesus. You know, he'd never met him and they'd never met him. But his conviction and his inner experience of the transforming power of Christ consciousness, because Paul was a deep meditating yogi. He used the phrase, "I die daily by the grace of Jesus Christ," which is a yogic way of saying, I leave this body ceases to exist for me, I go into the infinite consciousness, I go into the Christ consciousness by the grace of my guru. There's many things in the life of Paul that indicate that he knew what he was doing. But he had to have known what he was doing because of the power he had. Just by the sheer understanding that he had, he was able to awaken others who had no idea what he was talking about and no direct experience, but he could convey his experience to them. You know, it puts into perspective partly what Rick was saying, that you have to have contact. That's how Master writes it in another place, and Swami says it. You have to have some direct contact with the guru. There has to be some physical contact, but it can come through a disciple. Because the disciple who is in tune has the vibration of the master. So you have to understand all of this. None of this is physical. When the master lives in that body, he's so not limited or defined by that body. It's just the visible form that allows him to relate. And he's been in human bodies. He's lived through the karma. And now his vibration is free. That's why Swami tries to use words like vibration or this ray. And that's why Swami's own energy, which not all of you, but most of you were here sometime over the summer and saw him. That's why his energy is so unusual. A couple of years ago when he came here, he was very unwell. And he came out on the platform to give a talk. And Shanti was here, Shanti Rubinstone, who's a medical doctor. And she described what happened to her. As a medical doctor, she was looking at a body that she thought was going to collapse at any moment, that the heart would stop or just something would happen. And as she put it, she was on the edge of her seat as a doctor, ready to rush forward and resuscitate him when he just simply passed out because he was so, to her eye, just physically in trouble. Simultaneously, she was paralyzed or made motionless by the most overwhelming spiritual force she had ever experienced, that just froze her in her chair and made all movement and virtually all thought impossible. And she just was living both realities simultaneously, and because they were equally true, that there was nothing in the material form that justified what was happening on the spiritual form. And that's what Swami's been this whole visit. You know, there's just like, and you look at him, he's 81, and all of a sudden he looks 18. There's no age to the form, even though it's old. And then he'll finish, and then all of a sudden he has to be helped off the stage, and you just don't even know what to do with it, because you're seeing vibration, and we're experiencing vibration, and we're all vibration. That's what we all are. We're all the vibration of Om. It's been described in the Gita commentary. Actually, a lot of what I'm thinking was in the Revelations book, but it's all just the movement of Om. That's why sound is so powerful, because it is our own nature. So when that vibration comes out to us and we're in tune with it, it's like any sound. It makes us the same as that sound. Now, the more we identify with that vibration, simultaneously, the less we identify with the ego self. And the more we identify with that vibration, the more we just effortlessly merge into it. There's no self to worry about whether or not I'm accepted, I'm good enough, I'm pretty enough, whether I did my kriyas enough, or any of those things. It just goes out of your mind because the vibrations just merge. This is why the story of Master's niece, Shefley, Hare Krishna's sister, Hare Krishna Ghosh, whom some of you have met, was Master's brother's son. Hare Krishna was 15 in 1936 when Master went to India for the 1 year he spent back in India after he left in 1920. Shefley was 3. And Shefley, being 3 years old, didn't have a lot of intellectual capacity to reason things out. She just saw Master, and she thought he was just about the most lovable thing in the room, and she was just not going to be deterred. And that she doesn't remember, but she tells the story about her. She just, whenever Master was anywhere near, she just absolutely insisted on being on his lap, on his arm, you know, and she just wouldn't hear of anything else. And it's such a touching thought, because on one hand you think, what a waste. She was so little, you know, because we're so attached to our reason. On the other hand, you think, what a gift, she was so free. Because there was just nothing to stop her. That's why Jesus said, be as little children, for as such are the kingdom of God. There was just that assumption that loved, secure children have. Of course you'll love me. Why would you not? And that's what Jesus was referring to. There's no inhibition. There's just the sense that it's beautiful and that's what I want. And that's the relationship that we have to develop with Master, with God inside, with Divine Mother, with our Guru Bhais, and certainly with any spiritual teacher that comes, you know, within our purview who's going to help us. Because insofar as we're self-concerned, to that extent we are out of tune. And I don't mean out of tune in like some, you know, admonishment way, but we're not able to be in tune. We're not able to receive, because what we're receiving is vibrations. And if our vibrations are vibrating with self-concern, God is there trying to love us, and we're so worried about whether he'll love us or not. You see, oh, will he love me? I don't know if he'll love me. He's sitting there trying to love us, and we're just worried about whether he'll love us. I mean, think about it in your own life. Your people that you want to give to, if they won't let you give to them, you can't give to them. And it has nothing to do with anything except what Jesus said in the Bible to all those who received him. Now, because of that, we think of God as Mother, we think of God as Father. We try to, and Jesus came and brought that image, because when Jesus came, the Jews thought of God as the judge, and a kind of a scary judge at that, because he seemed to know a lot of rules that you didn't know, and the whole Jewish religion had degenerated. It was not what Moses taught, because Moses was an avatar, but it had degenerated into just a whole lot of rules, and you had to follow every single one of them. I mean, Jesus was a Jew speaking to Jews, and there was all this discussion. Your disciples have not done the ritual washing of their hands. That makes them unclean. And Jesus says it's not what a man puts into his mouth before eating. Jesus said it's not what a man puts into his mouth that makes him unclean. It's what comes out of his mouth that makes him unclean. I mean, he was just trying to break the most materialistic concept of religion. But so Jesus tried to say God is the Father. And then he said things like, if the son asks the father for a loaf of bread, will the father give him a stone? And then he tells the story of the prodigal son and how the son returns and the father's just so happy to have him home. He doesn't care what he's been through. He's just so glad that he's come back. These are all just trying to get people to understand, don't be afraid. God is your own. And then Master came, and Master took it a step farther, and he talked about God as the mother, which is even more intimate, more forgiving, you know, less fear-induced. You know, the children cling to their mothers because that's where they feel safe. You see, it's so instructive to watch the way little children behave. I go to the YMCA, and I see a lot of little children there, and, you know, I swim, and they're trying to get these children to swim, and you just see these kids, it's just so cute. You know, they just have a grip on their mother's skirt. And they're behind the mother, and the mother's trying to coax the little child into the pool, and the child will have none of it, you know, but where the child feels safe is just gripping on to the mother's skirts. But it's a wonderful image for us. We need to hold on to our Divine Mother's skirts. But then Master just brings in this such a sweet and subtle point. He says, all relationships except friendship have an element of compulsion to them. Because after all, she is your mother. She has to take you back. He is your father. You are his son. It's a fixed relationship. He has to do it. There's an element of duty. You know, between lovers, there's an element of duty. Between husband and wife, there's an element of duty. But friend is entirely freely chosen. And it helps us to understand, and this is what he's on two sides, what he's trying to say to us. The other side about friend is that it's a relationship of equals. And this is where in the Bible, toward the end of Jesus' life, he says to his disciples, you call me master, but I call you friend. And then he says, a servant is not privy to the business of the master. He simply does what the master wants him to do, but he doesn't share in an understanding of it. But the friend of the master shares with him, stands equal with him, and embraces the same reality and responsibility and goal that the master has. That's why Jesus called the disciple friend. Because he was saying to the disciple, you have to rise to this level. Now, there's a quality in the Indian teaching called bhav, B-H-A-V. It's a very subtle and beautiful word. It sort of translates a little bit as mood, but not moodiness. It's more like the mood of a song or the mood of a moment. And every devotee has their own particular bhav. It's a very sweet word. Which is the way in which they choose to have their romance with the divine. And you can have the bhav, and that's why we say, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved. And it's not Beloved God. It's very hard to say that right. It's Father, Mother, Friend, Beloved. Because these are all different bhavs that you can have with God. You can think of him all that way. The third, the one that we don't mention is, you can also have the bhav of worshiping God as your own child. That's why the baby Krishna, and there are people who just their whole lives, their relationship is with the baby, whatever form it is, and they mother, they take care of it, they love it, and because it's babies are so heart-opening, it's a very sweet bhav. And it's also all of these different bhavs tell us how to relate in human life in such a way as to spiritualize every relationship we have. If it was God himself that you were serving, how would you serve? But of all of those, Master said that friendship is the highest because it puts you eye to eye with the Guru and with God. And in order to have the inner freedom to rise to that level, and also, he said again, because it's completely free of coercion, there's no demand in it. That's the highest relationship is friendship. And when God speaks to Arjuna and calls him friend, you see, also, he's acknowledging the extraordinary state of realization that Arjuna has attained, that his is a partnership now, an equal partnership with God. It also means, and this is also what Jesus was saying, the servant doesn't really take responsibility for the master's work, but the friend will. So it's also, it's a teaching about service and the importance of service and giving back to what you're doing. To grow up in our own understanding, which is to say really that one can run many different bhavs at the same time. But the ideal even of motherhood is friendship. All relationships, the ideal is friendship, because that is the freely chosen one. So this is a beautiful element of the spiritual path, which is just one word going across in the Gita, but tells us a whole world of spiritual teaching. I don't think I have anything else to say. If I have any questions, I'll take them. Otherwise, I'm done. All right. So we have 2 weeks off. So I'll see you whatever the last week of August or whatever it is. 28th, the last week of August. Thank you.